good horse, I call you my shiny black bears. To the playhouse of fortune, to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else. And this we go.
You're listening to episode 678 of Unwelcome Guests, The New Pearl Harbor, Part 2. I'm Robin Upton. As the title suggests, we're continuing where we left off last time, the radio adaptation of Massimo Mazzuccio's brand new 9/11 film, which updates the pretty compelling arguments we've already heard with some fresh evidence. That's going to be in our second hour, because the first hour we're going to hear from filmmakers and journalists Bob Cohen and Eric Nadler about their 7-year journey into the trail of anthrax, and the connection, of course, with 9/11 is the one aspect that isn't covered in Massimo Mazzuccio's The New Pearl Harbor. But call me a conspiracy theorist if you like, but I think it has to be looked at in the light of the events of September the 11th, another remarkably fishy government story, the so-called Amerithrax case, which $100 million on, the FBI tried to pin on lone nut Bruce Ivins. And this recording is from June 2009.
This is Eric Nather.
And Bob Cohen.
Authors of Dead Silence, Fear and Terror on the Anthrax Trail.
For more information, please go to our website, www.anthraxwar.com, where you can get information on the film, the book, and also how to organize a screening and get involved and learn more about this very important subject of germ warfare. Thanks a lot, Joan, and thanks to everybody for being here tonight. It's been 7 years in the making. We began this journey together 7 years ago. It all really started with those anthrax attacks. It's interesting that this story is not getting the attention it deserved. And you all know that those anthrax attacks happened. They were in the headlines for a few months, and there was fear and terror around the country, the globe, copycat attacks. And then things went really quiet, disappeared from public consciousness, faded from the headlines. And everybody remembered 9/11. 9/11 and the anthrax attacks happened around the same time. They were the 1-2 punch against the Republic. Eric and I both were intrigued why this story disappeared, why the FBI was not getting to the bottom of this as it should have. And that's what really began this process for us. I'll hand it over to you, Eric.
Right. Basically, I've been an investigative reporter for many years, and I've somehow found myself studying weapons of mass destruction. I did a film in 2002 called Stealing the Fire, which aired here in the United States on the Sundance Channel and internationally broadcast, and we had a theatrical release about the underground network of nuclear weapon components. And I was screening that film in a Greenwich Village theater when Bob came out of the shadows, and I hadn't seen him for 12 years. And Bob said, "Hey, remember me?" Bob and I worked together on a PBS program called South Africa Now, which was a PBS program that was put together in the final days of the apartheid regime and that chronicled the rise of Mandela and the freedom of South Africa. And Bob was based in Africa, and he spent a couple of months in the United States. I was the investigative editor of that show, and he and I worked together. But then he returned to Africa, and after 12 years, I hadn't seen him. And then he came and said, "I'm back in the United States, and what's up with these anthrax attacks?" And Bob had a special relationship with anthrax.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things for me, anthrax was special for me in the sense that a very little known fact is that the largest outbreak of anthrax in modern history took place in my home country of Zimbabwe at the height of the Liberation War in 1978, when the Rhodesian regime was in its last stages and the regime was desperate to hang on to power at any cost. The Liberation War was at its height. And this very mysterious anthrax epidemic ravaged the country. 10,000 cases, almost 200 people died in a year. And those figures had never been seen anywhere in the world. They were way off the charts. I mean, they would have maybe 100 cases a year. And we have to remember that anthrax actually is a naturally occurring bacteria. It occurs naturally in large parts of Africa, Asia, even, I believe, in some parts of the American continent. And, but the anthrax, when it's used as a weapon, it is actually militarized and it is milled and adapted to make it an even more deadly weapon. In any event, this anthrax epidemic went unnoticed in most of the world. But later on, you know, I left Zimbabwe, Rhodesia at the height of that war to escape conscription. I came to the United States and returned a few years later to begin work as a filmmaker and a journalist. And in the course of my work as a journalist, I discovered that the Rhodesian forces had used biological weapons, cholera, anthrax, chemicals in their fight against the black guerrillas and the black population who was supporting the guerrillas. And I became fascinated with this. And later on, some of my films dealt with the struggle against apartheid and the liberation wars in southern Africa, Mozambique, Angola. And I uncovered sort of pretty widespread use of chemical and biological agents by the South African regime. And was always intrigued by this. And I knew some of my classmates had actually gone on to serve with some of these special forces units. I began asking questions, and I began to realize that, in fact, these agents had been used. It was not very well documented. It's been shrouded in secrecy. A lot of these soldiers did not want to speak about this. There's been a lot of denials from different authorities. In any event, I never really looked into it carefully. I had compiled some information, some anecdotal information, had spoken to people. But then I left Zimbabwe in 2001, came back to New York City, and I just happened to arrive as the anthrax attacks were happening. I wondered to myself, might there be a connection with the anthrax attacks and what took place in my home country of Zimbabwe back in the 1970s? And that's when I began looking into this. And that's when I discovered that my colleague, my former colleague, Eric, had just finished this amazing film on the nuclear underground and reached out to him and said, this is something we should look into. And that's how this whole thing began. And one of the first things that we did in this is to really understand the anthrax attacks. One has to look into the world of germ warfare. And this is a world that is shrouded in secrecy. This is something that's been going on for a long time, 65 years since World War II. But it is something that is hidden, something that people don't want to talk about. And it really comes down to what it really is about. Germ warfare is fundamentally a subversion of the life sciences. Science is supposed to be positive, to come up with cures, find ways to help people. Well, germ warfare is exactly the opposite. It's taking the life sciences and turning them into the death sciences. How can we kill more people? This is a really dark world. And what we decided to do pretty early on was to look at the history of this world and also look at the global dimension of this world. This wasn't just something that was happening in America. This is something that's been going on around the world. And that's what we had to do. We had to begin by starting to look at this world of germ warfare.
Now, it's very interesting. Last night there was a program on PBS, The American Experience, from 9 to 10 o'clock last night. And they said, tonight, germ warfare revealed. And what they dealt with was germ warfare from 1945 to 1969. And that's the story that's generally well told. The story from 1969 to the present is generally a pretty secret story. And that's what Bob and I decided to update 69 going forward. And the story from 45 to 69 is both the Germans and the Japanese and the British had fairly active anthrax programs in World War II. The Japanese actually used anthrax as a germ weapon during the Second World War in Manchuria. It was their unit was called Unit 731. After the war, their scientists were taken prisoner by both the U.S. and the Soviet Union and the British, and they were debriefed. And basically, the Allies began a very aggressive germ warfare program through the 50s and 60s. In 1969, Richard Nixon and Henry Kissinger decided that germ warfare was, in effect, the poor country's best weapon. And while they had an edge in nuclear arsenals, they decided that it would be a good idea to outlaw the work on germ warfare to prohibit other countries from getting a leg up on this thing. So by Nixon in 1969, we have it in the movie, a very nice clip, said we're going to basically outlaw all research and development to offensive germ warfare capability from this moment forward. And that was passed by Congress in 72, and 173 countries or something like that eventually ratified that piece of business, and a very strong treaty was put in effect. And people we interviewed for our film and for the book actually believed that this genie was put back in the bottle, this evil gene, germ warfare genie, was done with. But what happened in the late 80s is a couple of defectors from the Soviet Union emerged, and they revealed that the Soviets had for many years been violating the treaty and had been conducting the most dangerous offensive germ warfare capabilities. In response, the West continued or moved forward in their own offensive germ warfare capabilities. And people came to realize that at the bottom line, there was no difference between offensive or defensive germ warfare. In other words, in order to do a defensive program, you had to establish an offensive program. In essence, and it carries over into today, and this is the most dangerous thing that's happened currently, but in response to the Soviets, if you found that the Soviets were taking anthrax and they were playing with it with recombinant DNA or kind of a genetic manipulation, you had to say to yourself, geez, how do we come up with a vaccine for this? So there were laboratories whose work was to take anthrax, genetically manipulate it, or add recombinant DNA, or as some expert, a virologist we interviewed said, mess with it. They'd mess with it, thus creating germs never seen before in the world, and then they would study to see how you could make a vaccine with it. And to many people, this was the same as offensive germ warfare. And in effect, that's what we've seen over the last, especially 10 years, 20 years. Once the Soviet defectors came out and the fact that germ warfare was once again in play, and especially in the anti-terrorism years that germ warfare was back in play, you've seen this explosion in biodefense work all over the world. In the United States alone, there's been $50 billion spent since the anthrax attacks on biodefense. And many astute observers of this believe that there's no difference between biodefense and biooffense. And if you're sitting in Beijing or Tehran or Moscow, you're seeing this biodefense program in the United States as a big offensive program. And so when we began to look into, okay, who was behind the anthrax attacks, who benefits, who gains, Where is the FBI not looking? One of the things that we came to the conclusion about, that nobody was looking upon the private sector of folks benefiting from this biodefense boom in the wake of the anthrax attacks. And we don't make any outlandish conspiracy charges in either the book or the film. We just ask the legitimate question that people who had the means, who dealt with these germs and had the motive, maybe a profit motive, maybe they actually seized the opportunity. And maybe there was a profit motive behind the anthrax attacks. And we just put a big question mark there. The FBI, and Bob will go into this in a second, but the FBI immediately began to narrow the investigation upon a lone gunman. And it's always easy to think that some guy went crazy for his own reasons. He decided to embark upon this act of terrorism. But then the question raised its head for us. Could there be institutions, individuals, corporations, or some intersection that might think it worth putting some anthrax in the mail for $50 billion in contracts? And I don't think that's a conspiratorial question. I think that's a legitimate question to ask, and one that was never really asked in this entire investigation. And to us, it made more sense to look at that angle. Bob and I came of age during the Woodward and Bernstein era, follow the money. And basically, to me, that's always the first place you look. So we began looking to see who benefited and who gained rather than some lone crazy gunman. And what we found is that what used to be the work of a handful of secret government laboratories has become essentially privatized over the last 20 years. And there's enormous profits to be made in biodefense and enormous profits to be made by scaring people. And so one of the things we do in the film and in the book is we name names. We show the corporations and their political connections to the highest levels of a succession of presidential governments. It's not a Republican issue or a Democratic issue. I mean, there are people in biodefense firms close with the Clinton administration, close with Bush 1, close with Bush 2, close with Obama, which is an interesting piece of business, too, we'll go into in a while. But, in other words, it's not a conspiratorial question to ask who made money off the anthrax attacks, who benefits, who gains, and why does the FBI, against all the available evidence, if you study it very closely, why are they sticking to their lone gunman theory when it just doesn't add up? And I think it's quite clear, as we say in the book and the film, to open that Pandora's box of germ warfare and to start seeing where the money is flowing is something that the government just doesn't want to do at this point in time. And one of the great things we did is, as Bob said, it just wasn't an American story. This is a story with a relative handful of players who all know each other and knew each other over the years. And so that took us around the world.
Yeah, in many ways, I think this aspect of biodefense becoming this huge cash cow was something that we discovered, you know, once we got into this. Looking into, first of all, this world of biological warfare. And if you remember, very soon after the anthrax attacks, the FBI narrowed their interest on this person of interest, who was a guy called Stephen Hatfield, who was an Army scientist who was working in one of the top secret biodefense labs for Dietrich, and who also, very interestingly, had connections that went back to Africa and to my home country of Zimbabwe. And Stephen Hatfield had claimed that he had served with special forces in Rhodesia at the time of the anthrax outbreak, with this one particular unit called the Sulu Scouts, which was a counterinsurgency unit that did a lot of dirty tricks operations. And Stephen Hatfield was in the headlines. That was very intriguing and was one of the things we started looking into. But we quickly realized that perhaps Stephen Hatfield, even though there were these very interesting connections with him, was perhaps a diversion. But we did meet a very interesting fellow very early on when we began this investigation on the internet. And this fellow was a private investigator. And his name was Stephen Dresch. And Stephen Dresch was a remarkable man. He was actually an economist by training and was the dean of a business school and in Michigan. And went on to become a private – he was actually a state legislator for the Republican state legislator in Michigan and served for 2 years in the state legislature there and then basically turned his attention to being a private investigator and fighting corruption. And Stephen Dresch had, in 1998, gotten into the world of anthrax – when a company by the name of Bioport, and this was a company that basically was in the business of vaccines, specifically the anthrax vaccine. And Bioport was able to get a little lab in Michigan, a state lab, and was able to buy it for not very much money. What was it?
$10
million. No cash down deal. And immediately, they privatized it. They were able to was a contract with the U.S. Army to supply the anthrax vaccine for the U.S. military, the sole supply of the anthrax vaccine. And so Stephen Dresch thought something was up here, and he started looking into this. And he discovered that the head of this company was a Lebanese-German businessman called Fuad El-Hibri. And it had turned out that El-Hibri had actually bought a similar business in the UK when the United Kingdom privatized its own part of its own biodefense industry. The Thatcher years, El-Hibri was able to buy a portion of that and privatize that and supply anthrax vaccine to Saudi Arabia and other places. And he thought that this was something that really needed to be looked into. And he kicked up a big fuss and called for investigations and all this. And we discovered Stephen Dresch on the internet, and he, just after the anthrax attacks, where he was writing a letter to Congress basically saying that for Congress to really understand the anthrax attacks, we really have to look at those who profit from anthrax and the global connections of anthrax, that you could not just look at this in America. The FBI could not just look at this as an American thing. We had to look at the UK. We had to look at South Africa. We had to look at the Soviet Union, and that there were very important clues to be found in all this.
And Bioport and the El-Hibri is a very important piece of business in the sense that when Congress asked a couple of questions like who are these people actually buying the only anthrax vaccine operation in the United States, and they found out, okay, they own the only anthrax vaccine operation in the UK. Well, they got down to a series of holding companies that were based in the Netherlands Antilles, that were based in the Dutch Caribbean, offshore. And so basically they asked El-Hibri during congressional testimony, where did you get the seed money to actually make this purchase? And he answered, I got it from a company called INF Holdings, and that's my father, Ibrahim El-Hibri. Nobody in Congress asked him if Ibrahim had a business partner in that company. And so we come to a moment where we understand that the only anthrax vaccine companies in the UK and the United States were owned by people we had no idea who they were. And the fact that this is owned in the offshore havens is problematic. And when the anthrax attacks happened years later, Dresch zeroed in on this, and we came together with Dresch thinking this is a very important piece of business. Now, Bioport has held on to those contracts through the years. For the $10 million that they actually paid for the physical facilities, originally they got $130 million in government contracts, and that was for just the original vaccines. After the anthrax attacks, after the first Gulf War, the vaccine was made mandatory for all troops deployed overseas. After the anthrax attacks, it was mandatory for all U.S. troops, and they're moving towards first responders and also in addition to the national stockpile. Their contracts now total over $1 billion. Okay. So we thought it interesting to – we're not pointing any fingers, but we wondered if the FBI had ever looked at Bioport and this company as perhaps people who could benefit from an anthrax attacks. The only time it actually came up in real time was the man they eventually said committed the anthrax attacks, Bruce Ivins. And we haven't even talked about the Ivins attacks, Ivins relationship here, which is very interesting, because the FBI only named him as the principal suspect a couple of days after he committed suicide. And he was dead, and they said he did it, and we're closing the case now. And this was 7 years after the attacks, and after they had gotten a lot of heat from Congress. Senator Grassley on 60 Minutes called it a closed case. Stephen Hatfield, who Bob referred to, was named only as a person of interest, and because they put him in the spotlight, he eventually sued the government, and he won. He collected $5.8 million. 6 weeks after he collects the $5.8 million, Ivins commits suicide. They say he's the guy, and they close the case. And, of course, any of their evidence cannot be tested in a court of law at that point in time. Most polls indicate that 70% of the American people think this is hogwash, and there's good reason for that. So, as part of the rationale for why Ivins did it, the FBI leaked documents that said, well, you know, he was a government scientist working at the U.S. Army laboratory at Fort Detrick, top secret facility. And one of the things he was doing, of course, was working on the anthrax vaccine. And he had a patent worth, he could have made $20,000 if there was an anthrax scare. Well, once the FBI said, oh, this individual could make $20,000, establishing profit as a possible motive, we thought it was well within the bounds to think about a company or corporations that could make billions of dollars on this. And this is all we do is suggest this in this book. We can't go further because of lawyer matters. They're all very careful about this. But Bioport became a company called Emergent BioSolutions, and as the entire stock market dived last year, September, October, November, December, we found it interesting. They went up 400%. They became an extremely profitable piece of business. They lost some money this year, but for the time, if you go back on the internet and the film, we were able to get the clips. They're touted as the hottest stock on Wall Street. If you invest in only one stock, Emergent BioSolutions is it. Jim Cramer on, you know, his crazy Mad Money show said, I like it, I like it, I like it. So there was a lot of money to be made in the wake of the anthrax attacks. And all we do in this book and the film is suggest that the FBI doesn't want to open that Pandora's box, beginning to look at corporations who might be able to benefit. We have no evidence that this corporation, I will be very clear for our national radio audience, that we have no evidence that this corporation was involved in any way, shape, or form with it. But we have no doubt that they profited from the after effects of the anthrax attacks. And I think that's a legitimate area of investigation.
Yeah, absolutely. One of the interesting things about our journey was, Yeah, we just talked a bit about Bruce Ivins. And Bruce Ivins, as you well know, was August last year, August 1st. The FBI announced, we've got our guy. Unfortunately, he's just committed suicide. And as Eric explained, then the fact is, you know, the case against him would never have to be proven in court. When that happened, we were actually in the edit room, almost done with our film. And we'd spent 6 years looking into this and traveling all around the world.
Most of it was just trying to raise money for the film. You know, yeah. We kept looking at right. investigating, but 7-year journey was the real hard part was getting money for the film.
And absorbing it all.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
Indeed. Sort of looking at this puzzle and trying to make sense of it as well. But one of the things that we started looking into early on after meeting our private eye Dresch, and Dresch is a really fascinating character. When we met him, you know, he was something straight out of a detective story, detective movie, wore trench coat, chain smoker. But he was a real thing. He wasn't a poser.
Well, the one story comes into our office.
Right, I think we should read. Why don't we read it for you? Let's do some reading here for you.
He was going to be the central character of our movie, and then he passed away of lung cancer before we could finish filming. So Bob filled the bill. But
when Cohen told Nadler that he had met a like-minded soul over the internet, Nadler logged on too, heading for Dresch's personal website. He ignored the funky portal with its ghostly charcoal sketch of the author, apparently a scan of a sidewalk portrait done by an Arbat street artist in Moscow, and dove into the website's meat. Dresch was posting not only long memos he wrote to congressional leaders and FBI officials overseeing aspects of the anthrax case, but also some hard-to-find documents he had unearthed relative to the investigation. Dresch was clearly intrigued with the international aspects of the case, roads that Nadler and Cohen had not yet connected to Amerithrax in any definite fashion. He was focused on the South African apartheid state's anthrax activities within its notorious germ warfare program, Project Coast. Perhaps there was a Johannesburg connection to the anthrax attacks. Dresch was willing to share leads with Cohen. His standard MO favored the inclusive, and he regularly traded information with professional and citizen journalists. Dresch talked regularly with writers from the New York Times, Washington Post, and FreeRepublic.com, and posted relevant documents on the web as soon as he obtained them. Both Cohen and Adler liked the fact that he was working the case pro bono and had built up a small international network of other investigators. There was a Russian with KGB connections, a South African investigative journalist, and assorted arms dealers living in southern climes who all had all signed on to help. Dresch, it seemed, was a full-service operation, and a fearless one at that. His leads linked anthrax to intelligence agencies, multinational corporations, and secret military operations. And he would thank all his sources, no matter how sinister the leads they provided, with a calm sign-off, instructions to carry on. Nadler and Cohen were particularly impressed with the 1994 memo Dresch had promised to share. It was a top-secret report from the South African Army Surgeon General to South African President Nelson Mandela, detailing how the military allegedly dumped the deadly stocks from its notoriously racist germ war program into the South Atlantic Ocean shortly after the fall of apartheid. The actual fate of these so-called legacy stocks had been ambiguous for years. This document, if true, was a nice part of the puzzle. "We've got to meet this guy," Nadler said to Cohen. "Ask him if he's heading to New York soon." That afternoon, they called Michigan and invited Dresch to come to Brooklyn for a discussion about a documentary collaboration and all things germ-related. The next day, the detective hopped into his reconverted 1989 Chevy police cruiser and, fueled by black coffee and unfiltered nicotine, drove 40 hours for the meeting. When Dresch walked into their office on a gray winter day in 2003, he was enveloped in smoke and wrapped in a battered gray trench coat, a character straight out of central casting. He was articulate, clear-eyed, sober, and just a tad melodramatic. Crossing the office to stand before the picture window overlooking the East River, Dresch peered at the high-rises across the water in Manhattan and shook his shaggy head. "I don't like it," he grumbled. It's a clear sniper shot from the other side. He kept a straight face for a beat and then allowed the briefest of smiles to escape. Now, what exactly can I do for you fellows? So that was our kind of introduction to Dresch, and he was a real important part of this whole investigation, gave us some amazing leads to follow. Unfortunately, like Eric said, he died of lung cancer in 2006 before we really had gotten the money to go out and do the serious investigation. But we followed a lot of his leads, and, you know, Dresch had it right from the beginning.
He was a fairly eccentric fellow, but he actually earned a living and supported a family by being an investigator for Lloyd's of London. And he actually made headlines, national headlines, a couple of times during the years we knew him. He actually learned from a mafia gangster who he was representing in prison. Dresch did not like the RICO statutes, the racketeering statutes, and the mob didn't like them either. So Dresch was working with a fellow by the name of Gregory Scarpa, who was a associate of one of the Soprano crime families back in New York. And Scarpa told him that he learned through jailhouse grapevine that there was a second cache of explosives used by the Oklahoma City bombers, and it was actually buried to that day in a house under a house in Kansas City. And Dresch pestered the FBI, and they finally went and they found it. They found explosives in the house, and basically he got credited for that in national publications. He also was instrumental in getting an FBI agent in New York indicted for murder in various mob-related shenanigans. And so Dresch was a serious fellow who would write all kinds of interesting and important notes to federal investigators, the FBI, and also Congress people. But he wasn't really taken that seriously. We took him seriously, and we liked where he led us. And he was going to be the perfect guy for a film, but then he passed away. And we couldn't use him, though we used him in half the film. But his important piece of business was that you can't focus on the lone gunman. You've got to look at international connections. This is a this is a kind of a small world that's connected. And then I think he was actually fascinated with one case, which is fairly bizarre here, about the case of Larry Ford. Which cuts into the African situation. Right. So maybe you want to take us through that a little bit.
Well, you know, it's interesting because, you know, it started for me in Africa and then realized, and Dresch had realized fairly early on, and this is what very interesting about meeting Dresch, that he had, you know, quite separately focused on Africa as well. And one of the key pieces of this whole puzzle was the South African apartheid state's germ warfare program, a program called Project Coast. And it was headed by a guy called Wouter Basson, who was later dubbed Dr. Death. And basically, this was a very sophisticated program that employed about 200 scientists to develop germ weapons that could be used for assassination of anti-apartheid activists, could be used against the black population. They could be used to poison different parts of black population. And also one of the big things that they tried to work on was the development of an ethnic weapon, a weapon that would target the South Africa's black population, specifically coming up with a way of sterilizing the population without them knowing, make black women infertile, put this stuff in water. When I went to South Africa, Dr. Death was actually put on trial. What happened was after the fall of apartheid, there was something called the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, where a lot of the misdeeds of apartheid regime came to the fore. And some of these scientists came forward and said, look, we did this. And all of a sudden, this secret program was exposed. And as a result of investigators looking into this, they discovered some trunks that were hidden with these documents that were supposedly destroyed. They were able to put Dr. Death on trial for murder, for starting a cholera epidemic. It was he was charged with 66 counts of murder alone. This trial dragged on for 30 months. In the end, he was found not guilty.
But based
by a judge. Yeah, there wasn't a jury, and it was a highly politicized trial. And one of the things that emerged in this trial, and what's very important about this trial is that this was one of the rare times where this world of germ warfare, which is really hidden, was able to sort of come out in a court of law where information and documents were made available. A lot of stuff was classified and did not come made public, but what did come out really gave people a glimpse into this very sophisticated program that not only worked in isolation in South Africa but had connections around the world, intelligence connections, connections with the governments. And a year ago when I was in South Africa, I approached Dr. Death to see if he would talk to me. And he's still practicing as a doctor to this day, and he's still on the payroll of the South African government. And basically he's been kept on, and he really knows a lot, this guy. And one of the reasons they've kept him on is that this is a guy who really knows all the secrets. And one of the things I used with Dr. Death to try to get him to talk, he hasn't really given that many interviews at all. And everybody's sort of in South Africa knows about Project Coast and what these the bad things that they've done. And I approached them and said, well, you know, you guys are made out to be the bad guys, but we know that people helped you. And so how come you guys are getting the bad rep? So maybe you want to talk and tell us who helped you. And that got him to sit down with me. And what was pretty amazing was that he confirmed that he had visited Fort Detrick, had collaborated with the U.S. government, with the U.K. government, had gone to the U.K.'s biodefense lab of Porton Down. And there's this very strange fellow called Larry Ford, who was a gynecologist in California, and he specialized in treating Hollywood stars. I think Bianca Jagger was one of his
Margot Hemingway
was one of his clients. But Larry Ford was moonlighting on the side for the South African apartheid regime, Project Coast. He was flying over to South Africa, bringing things over for Dr. Death. And there are many suggestions that he was actually working for the CIA. We got a hold of Larry Ford's FBI file, but I'll just go back a little bit. Larry Ford in March 2000, shot himself in the head in California's Irvine, killed himself. A lot of mystery surrounding this death. Basically, the FBI took over the police investigation. A lot of stuff was classified. The police basically went to his house, were tipped off by an FBI informant that the house was full of very strange germs and weapons. They discovered a cache of weapons. They discovered containers of germs that were taken away. All that stuff is classified. We don't know to this day what the FBI took away from that home. We got hold of his FBI file, and it's almost 100% redacted on national security grounds.
And the operative principle is that if the U.S. was a signatory to the bioweapons treaty, and they still wanted to conduct research on bioweapons, germ weapons effects, maybe it was done offshore in South Africa. And so the relationship between the United States government and the British government and the apartheid government's germ warfare program is completely shrouded in mystery. Ford is an interesting piece of business because maybe he relates to that. We interviewed at great extent a British member of parliament named Andrew McKinley, who actually raised in the British Parliament questions about the relationship between the British government and the apartheid government's germ warfare program. And he raised it in formal inquiries, and he showed us the response he got. He never got actual confirmation that, yes, we work with the South Africans, whatever. What he was able to obtain, that his questions prompted a meeting of the 13 leading intelligence and military directorates of the British government to decide how to answer these questions. And the answer was, we will not answer these questions. So he was able to show us these documents and conclude that the relationship between the UK and the South Africans is to this day the most one of the most closely guarded secrets of the British government. And the Ford case in California and his redacted FBI file and the bizarreness of actually evacuating an entire neighborhood in Irvine, California, of an upscale neighborhood. They went and they found all this stuff and they got everyone out of there for 2 weeks. And we interviewed guys who lived on that street and said we couldn't believe all this was happening. This South African connection on germ warfare and its relationship to the U.S. and the U.K. governments remains a very, very scary piece of business that's really been underreported. And that's one of the things that, you know, Fear and Terror on the Anthrax Trail is the subhead of this book. I mean, these things pop out in the media every so often. 60 Minutes did a piece on the Larry Ford case, and then it disappeared. The New York Times did a piece on the Larry Ford case. We talked to the reporter for the New York Times, who is now at the Syracuse University School of Communications, and we asked her to discuss this case with us, and she said, that's the one story I won't discuss with you guys. I don't even want to go near that one. And she, we had heard that she had a lot of editorial interference, and she said, that's absolutely correct, and good luck. And if you find anything else new, tell me about it. It sounds like you guys know too much about it. This all goes to saying that the whole notion of germ warfare is one of the least reported situations in international media. And it pops up every so often when it has to, like the anthrax attacks, there's interest. But a systematic follow-up of what's going on in the laboratories in the U.S. today. I'll just bring you one example that we found out that we find very interesting. There are levels of laboratories that exist in the biodefense network of the United States today. They have various classifications, BSL-1, BSL-2, BSL-3, BSL-4. BSL is biosafety level. Okay. One is common. Four is the most troublesome, where they handle the most deadly and lethal select agents. No antidote, no cure, always fatal. We discovered that there is one laboratory in the world today that is a BSL-4 lab that is in private hands, not government hands, private hands. That's in San Antonio, Texas. It's at a place called the Southwest Foundation for Biomedical Research. And, you know, you spend a few minutes on the internet figuring out what they are, and their history is amazing. This medical complex was founded in the post-World War II era by a fellow named Tom Slick. I kid you not, that's his real name. He was the son of a Oklahoma wildcatter oil magnate who attended Yale with the Bushes. During World War II, he became associated with the OSS, which was the forerunner of the CIA. And he actually ran an airline called Slick Airways, which has been linked to CIA proprietary airways through the years, doing special missions for the CIA. His biographer, a fellow by the name of Lauren Coleman, noted that his most public claim to fame was he organized searches for the abominable snowman, the Yeti, in India and China and Tibet. And his biographer asserts that these were cover expeditions done in order to smuggle the Dalai Lama out of China and into safe havens. So this is a very spooky guy who begins a city of science, he calls it, in San Antonio, Texas. And years later, they end up running the world's only privatized BSL-4 laboratory. We found this interesting. We went there with our cameras. They let us in. They were very friendly. They told us the kinds of things they do there. They have the world's largest primate collection in the world, baboons, who have the genetic makeup closest to the human makeup. So, what's going on there? We did some research on our own, found that they had several Department of Defense contracts investigating the effects of nerve gas, soman and sarin, upon the baboons. That's an interesting thing. Why are you doing that? And we also found out of their BSL-4 laboratory, of which they're quite proud. When we asked them what experiments they were doing in that BSL-4 laboratory, specifically involving anthrax, their public relations firm said they cannot release that information based on security considerations. So the question then raises its head all over the world. What's going on in these laboratories? And as I said earlier, what used to be done in government laboratories is now being done in privatized laboratories, which is beyond the scope of Freedom of Information Acts, which hides behind trade secrets and corporate walls. And one has to begin to worry about such things. And that's one of the things we at least bring to the fore in this book. We don't solve a lot of mysteries here. We just raise questions about what's going on a very scary piece of business. And look, these activities, this $50 billion boom in the private sector and aided and abetted by the U.S. military, is raising eyebrows in other countries. One thing we noticed as we were putting the finishing touches on an early draft of the film was that Putin in the Soviet Union, in his last address, I believe as prime minister, he's president now, addressed the Russian Duma, and he said that we have noticed that Western activities in nanotechnology, biotechnology and information technology has instigated a new arms race, and we will be taking actions. And we were shocked. This was not covered by the New York Times. This was not covered by the Baltimore papers. This was not covered by the Washington papers. This went unchallenged. And basically, here you have the Russian leader saying we're in a biological arms race caused by the West. At least you'd think they'd cover him saying that and then get the U.S. reaction, but it goes unmentioned. Now, I like to say that this whole germ warfare issue and even the anthrax attacks went totally unmentioned in the last presidential race. I just saw the other day on the internet that Obama did mention the FBI has taken too long to solve the anthrax attacks. That was his only mention. But this is off the radar of the press corps. And Bob and I have been working as serious journalists for reputable outlets for many years. Bob was a correspondent for CNN. I've worked for PBS Frontline and written for all kinds of magazines, The Nation, The New Republic, LA Times, etc. And when the decision is made by whoever that certain things are beyond the bounds of discussion, they don't get mentioned. And I think what we have here in this germ war arms race is one of the most important hidden stories of our time. And so, look, we can do what we do. We made a movie, we've written a book, and we're appearing at the grassroots level to get the word out about this. And we were on Capitol Hill last week at a congressional screening. A couple of congressmen came. Staffers came. There's a bill in Congress now introduced by Representative Rush Holt to establish a national commission to review the FBI's handling of the case. And I think that's of critical importance. They've, on the internet, Bob and I have been called conspiracy theorists and blah, blah, blah. I mean, and all that goes to show is that anyone who challenges the conventional narrative or asks a couple of questions beyond the narrow discourse of Washington journalism, they're going to throw a mud at you. So, but this is something we're willing to accept. But
yeah, and I just wanted to chime in. Maybe we should just read them Senator Patrick Leahy's words as a sort of, because that's a great way to counter the question of conspiracy.
So when we say that Bruce Ivins, and there's a lot of forensic evidence I won't bore you with, other than to say that, okay, I'll bore you a tad, that the sophisticated powder they found in the letters was sophisticated. Ivins worked with liquid anthrax at Fort Detrick, and his superiors and his co-workers, who we've interviewed there, said he lacked the skill set and the equipment to prepare that material. And the FBI has referred all forensic questions to a study forthcoming by the National Academy of Sciences. But what we found interesting is all through the years we were doing this, we tried to interview Senator Leahy, who's the chairman of the Judiciary Committee and has direct oversight over the FBI.
And was a target of
And was a target of the attacks. Right. And we got to Leahy's press guy, and he said, Senator Leahy never discusses the anthrax attacks in public. It's just a difficult thing for him. And in fact, if you actually looked at the public record, he very rarely said anything about it. But then there was a hearing last September, which we attended and filmed, and Leahy kind of let it all out. As we write, Leahy spoke with gravitas in a gravelly, languid voice, chiding the director of the FBI, Robert Mueller, who was testifying, for a bureaucratic bamboozlement. Finally, he dropped his detachment. Quote, I have been very reluctant to even ask questions about this because my office and myself were put at risk because of a letter that was addressed to me, and I realized we did not suffer like the families of those who had people die. And then he went on to say, I do not believe in any way, shape, or manner that Ivins is the only person involved in this attack on Congress and the American people. I do not believe that at all. I believe there are others involved, either as accessories before or after the fact. I believe there are others who can be charged with murder. And as we write, here was the chairman of the United States Senate Judiciary Committee charging conspiracy and cover-up at the center of one of the FBI's biggest cases ever, and it was broadcast live on C-SPAN. This was not internet chatter, but a powerful challenge to powerful interest by an impeccable source. It was a fantastic and important story, but that one that for whatever reasons would be ignored by the media, even cable. And for a news media that spends hundreds of hours on the debate whether Barack Obama's date was proper with his wife in Washington, when the chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee is charging conspiracy and cover-up, and it drops from public discourse, something's very, very wrong with our national discussion. And you know, they'll call us conspiracy theorists. All we're doing is quoting Senator Patrick Leahy. You can't do any more than that.